Bong Hawk and Lindar, but hopefully they're happy. I keep pens in this, and I had bought specifically a red weighted pen to write with, and it somehow has been displaced by these two pens that are on the front desk. If you're the party, take your own and put mine back, if you would. I need just to get a show of hands just for a couple of items, just to make sure on my own. How many of you have been able to get a copy of Alchemical Studies? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you, Robert, did you get one? 7? You've had one, so it's 8. So, about half of you. Okay. How many have been able to get a copy of A Midsummer Night's Dream? Most of you, or have a copy of Shakespeare around your house. Okay, good. Have any of you been able to get The Art of Memory? Sina has it? Do you have your copy with you? Okay. It should be in print and paperback, I think. Yeah. I have an old hardcover because that's the only way it came out years ago. Yeah. Bodhi Tree or Phoenix should have it. UCLA should have it. Okay. Now I'm giving you all of this material. Just do as much as you have time for. We're all mature and none of us are grade school students. I need to make the program as full as possible because this program has to do a lot of work for a long time, and it has to raise hopefully several generations of responsible human beings. So I have to pack it with all kinds of elements and material that you may not necessarily need or need to have to respond to, but I need to generate the full strength of this course. And so along with all other things, this is also a course in great books, great literature. In the 2-year cycle, one will have at least come into acquaintanceship with at least 2/3 of the classics of world literature that are considered indispensable for an educated human being. So I put all of this material in because this course needs to be protean. And I don't expect that there'll be many people that fulfill the whole situation, but I need to. So all of this is in here. If you're yet to buy A Midsummer Night's Dream, I like the new Cambridge Shakespeare. It's about $6.95. And let's see, this was re-edited 1984. Shakespeare has been edited and re-edited about every 2 or 3 years for the last couple hundred years. And this is the latest. And I like it because my first introduction to Midsummer Night's Dream was acting. And so I like something you can lift off the page and act. And so this is very handy for that sort of thing. Try and bring your copy of Midsummer Night's Dream next week, if you can. And Shakespeare is for sale in every bookstore in the world. This, I got this at UCLA. Now, for Alchemical Studies, I mentioned last week that there are 5 sections in here, 5 parts, 5 treatises, and that I want to spread the 5 out among the population of people so that 2 or 3 or 4 at the most work on each of the sections for a while. The reason for this is that alchemical studies as a volume is one of the most personal volumes in all of the collected works of Jung. Everything that's in here is like a wedge of his own personality, his own self-development. All of these five parts in here, when put together, give a really clear picture of Carl Jung. Alchemical studies is the esoteric autobiography. Memories, dreams, and reflections is for popular consumption. But alchemical studies is the underlying structure that made Jung work. And so we're using alchemical studies in the magic part of this course, because towards the end of these 3 months, we're going to see that when the individual gains conscious control over the psychic energy, what emerges is the human person. And so we want to use alchemical studies to show how, in fact, Carl Jung as a person emerged. And then we're going to have other correlations with it. So I'm using this for many structural reasons. So the first part in here is the secret of the golden flower. And are there any individuals who have decided to work together who would like to do that?
Yes, Robert and I.
Sina and Robert. Is there anybody else that would like to do that in connection with Sina and Robert? Dolores? And Donna? Okay, that's enough then for the secret of the golden flower. So you four, let the rest of alchemical studies go temporarily and just concentrate on that. Now, the secret of the golden flower that's in this volume is different from the translations that you have. It's fuller. It has emendations and corrections that have been made. Jung corrected it at least 4 or 5 times in his life. And so it's a marvelous, up-to-date version of it. The second one, Golden Flower. The second one is Visions of Zosimus. Is there anyone here that doesn't know who Zosimus was? Zosimus was a 3rd century sage, I guess is the word that I should use. I use the Jewish term. He was a sage. He was a late Hellenistic sage. He was a contemporary of Plotinus. And Jung says that the visions of Zosimus are the earliest complete cycle of the alchemical process. And they are also the key to dream therapy. So that there are two distinct and different directions that are wed together in the visions of Zosimus. One is, it's the summation of classic dream therapy in antiquity, which Jung picked up on and amplified to such an extent that Freud's interpretation of dreams is completely eclipsed by the way that Jung worked. And on the other hand, the alchemical lead, Jung kept looking for where does the buck stop? Where is the final referent? And he found that in the visions of Zosimus is the earliest presentation of the complete alchemical process. So we need a couple of people that will read this. Are there? Do you want to change? Carol, you'd like to do this? And Jerry? I always put an E on the end of your name, Carol. Did you want to do visions with? Okay. Donna, you would like to change? Yes, because you're interested in that aspect. Good. Okay. The third one is on Paracelsus, who is the single most Protean figure in the Renaissance. both Carl Jung and Manly Hall say that Paracelsus is the watershed, that he in himself, he was unable to live a very satisfactory human life. He died when he was like 48. He died when it was the age I am. And all of his life he was just torn because he had foisted on him, he had given to him in such a powerful way that we have to use the term foisted on him, two completely different traditions which were supposed to be wed. One was the scientific medical tradition and the other was the religious metaphysical tradition. And it was too soon to unite the two of them together, and his personality was just a constant turmoil. He was such a protean individual that he could carry this kind of neurotic thunderstorm around him all the time, but other people couldn't stand to be around him. But Paracelsus in himself was strong enough to hold it together. He had two masterful teachers, Trithemius, who gave him the religious tradition, and Solomon Trismegistus, who gave him the alchemical tradition. And the two were supposed to be wed in him, and he couldn't do it. Jung believed, I think quite firmly, that if he was a reincarnation of anyone, it was Paracelsus. And that it was Jung's mission to bring the medical and religious visions together. And so when he writes about Paracelsus, notice he entitles it Paracelsus as a Spiritual Phenomenon. So we need a couple of people to read this third section. Molly? And I'm Dan. Okay. Anybody? Okay. Fourth is the Spirit Mercurius. Mercury, of course, is the Latin for Hermes. Did you ever think that the planet nearest to the sun, instead of being called Mercury, in Greek would be called Hermes? The Spirit Mercurius. This is the key figure in the transformation process. In all the sequences of transformation, one single figure is always, in a protean way, there. It's just one figure, and it's always Mercurius. And as we'll see in this course in about 6 months, the knack, the technique, is to be able to look into that figure and see yourself. It's a very, very powerful discovery, and it's called realization. Realization is not a metaphysical, ambivalent, what if kind of experience. It's a very definite seeing yourself as that. As the Chandogya Upanishad says, Tat Tvam Asi, thou art that. At the center of the cycle of existence is a figure. And that figure is true. And the truth of that figure is you. You are the truth of the true. That was the ancient way in India that it was phrased. So for the Spirit Mercurius, we need a couple of people who will read this. Don and Lois. Okay. And the fifth one is the Philosophical Tree. Jung was very careful to make sure that when he wrote in a broad spectrum, that he chose synthesizing symbols that were able not only to unite the metaphorical language that he was using, but would relate back to world traditions. That is to say, that one could read this and relate it to whatever tradition it had come out of. Whether you're African, or whether you're Norwegian, or whether you're North American Indian, or whether you're a Texan. Is that a separate race? Anyway, the philosophical tree, that is to say the world tree, the tree image, is extremely powerful. And constantly, in the tree, are a bird and a serpent, who ostensibly are at war with each other, but who in the tree are both at home. And it's like the serpent winds itself around the trunk of the tree and the bird occupies the branches. But that those two are only able to be together if someone is there with them. Those powers do not war, but they energize the tree if there is someone there. If there's no one there, then the tree withers, and the bird goes hunting for the serpent to kill it, and the serpent goes hiding from the bird, hoping to trap it sometime. So we need a couple of people to do the philosophical tree. Chris, and Ed, and Jennifer. Which do you want? Okay, and Walter. Good, thank you. Okay, so that takes care of everyone that's here. Robert, which would you like? Think about it and let me know in a minute.
Now, what is our specific purpose?
Your purpose in this is to together read and talk this over and make a presentation to everybody else of what you found, of how you read it. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying at this point to get my voice out of the synthesizing process. I have to find techniques and ways so that your inner focusing, your inner synthesizing, begins to free itself from my voice, from my ideas, from the way in which I would present it. This is all important, because when we get to art, to the person making, you have to be convinced that the way in which you're thinking about things, that you can think about things at least equal to, if not better than me. And you have to understand that that's true. And though I carry all kinds of background and capacities, there's no sense of a pecking order after that kind of a point. Your way of looking at it for you is the way that you should follow. So that whatever I say after that, when we go into history and we go into science, my viewpoint is just part of the data that you consider in your own mind. Now, up to now, my voice has been able to carry it like a storyteller, but we have to be able to emancipate. You have to emancipate yourself from that. I'm not going to go away, and I'm still going to be there as transparently as possible, but this is a way of beginning now to find your feet, find your own ground. You're going to have a long time to do this. You're going to have a couple months to do this. And it's not, you don't have to make it complicated or big. 10 minutes. 10-minute presentation between the four of you, or between the three of you, or however it is. Just enough to show what this is and how you saw it. And always, of course, in this situation, you want to have the autobiographical qualities there. When you discovered that the separation of the inner personality from the physical body was an idea in The Secret of the Golden Flower that you had an experience of sometime in your life, don't talk about that experience, but talk about what were you doing when you realized that? Were you in your own home? Were you driving in the car? We want to make it have an existential quality to the discussion. Just like when you were doing your masks, remember making a journal to go along with the making of the mask? Save all of this data, because when we come to history, when we come to writing your own personal history in this situation, all of this will be material for you to unify in yet another way, a different way. I mentioned on Thursday, and I guess I'll mention to you here, because most of you are not coming on Thursday night. Though the process is of a single movement, it's just one movement. At every phase of the movement, as long as you're differentiating phases, the view of what the movement is changes and is totally different. So that when you come to expressive form, you can isolate factors in the movement. You can have, it's like in higher mathematics, you can characterize by innumerable locuses, innumerable dots on the graph, and at each dot, the overall configuration changes, sometimes very slightly, sometimes very dramatically. In life, it's just one movement. But in characterizing it as form, by thought mode consciousness, there are phases, there are stages, and the overall gestalt changes at every phase. So what you want to do is you want to be able to see it how you see it now and be open to see it in a different way all the time. So that eventually, the openness will become a part of how you see it, no matter how you see it from then on. I'm not talking double talk, I'm talking very specifically now. By weaving the openness into it, you add a dimension which at first is subconscious, but later on rises into consciousness just like that. I mean, is sudden, definite, and poignant. We begin to realize that you are tapping perspectives that you yourself never made up, never had in your particular life, but come from someplace hidden within you. A dimension that's actually working in your life, but you didn't realize that now you're tapping it and coaxing it to participate. And it's like the old saying was that wherever we walk together, there's a mysterious third that walks with us. And we would like to have that mysterious third have their say. And so we constantly are making more and more room for this. So that eventually one gets to the point to where you always leave at the table of events an open space. You just do. Now, I have written out for you, because I'm having to discipline myself to new dimensions, I've written out for you some of the material for today. So if I can just read this to you, and then we'll take a break. I wrote this about between 3 and 5 o'clock this morning. So you can have and you could make copies of this if you want. This is it. So this is the second lecture on magic. In volume 13 of the collected works of Carl Jung, published in 1967, the first of five sections is a translation of Jung's commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower. The given translation completes a cycle of editions and retranslations which had begun in 1929. He began work on it, incidentally, in 1928. Of particular initial interest to us is a phase of Jung's, a phrase of Jung's, which appears in his foreword to the second German edition, which they translate here on page 3. It was written in Zurich in 1938. The old doctor was recalling Richard Wilhelm and the effect his Taoist works had upon him, and he writes, "They not only lay far beyond everything known to academic psychology, but they also overstepped the bounds of any medical, purely personal psychology." The great realization was that medicine, in the modern European mode, was based on the personal shape of the individual. Methods and categories of diagnosis and therapy were directed to the person, and in this, limited. From this limitation, more apparent and convenient than actual, came the certainty of scientific objectivity. Also came the misunderstanding of the real person, whose actuality extends in prolific amplification beyond this limit. So much beyond that a cliché phrase is recorded from the millions who have experienced the larger dimension. The old, quote, person was just, quote, a shell. My old self was just a shell of what I have now become. Now, for us, in this education pattern, the essential lesson is that the person is important. And in this, we agree with Jung's emphasis overall to stress consciousness and the flowering and fruiting process, which he styled individuation. I have to put the referent in. Yet a simple, grand, strategic distinction must be made, and we make it as the best statement of our essential lesson. While the person is the fruit in the metaphor, the self is the flower. We cannot know the person until we know the self. The adventure of person-making is a sequel, organic enough as we shall see, yet a sequel nonetheless to the more primal adventure of self-discovery. That's capital S. To confuse the two, blurring this distinction, which is so basic, leads to inflation of the ego and all attendant ills. That is to say, let's pause here for a second, the inflation of the ego is a direct product of the lack of distinction between the self and the person, and that the distinction between the self and the person is a relational distinction. The classic formulation, if you must know, the archetypal formulation, was that the one is the father and the other is the son, or the one is the mother, the other is the daughter. It's like that. The interface between the self and the person is a process realm traditionally known as magic. Magic is the transformational media between the inner symbolic forms and the outer personal form, singular. As the self is in focus, so the person is clearly formed. Or, if the flower matures, you have fruit. Flowers that simply fade away were incapable of being human. We are considering magic as a transformational media. In our concern with understanding form, we make a symbolic shape, the mandala, the symbolic wheel. What is captured in this focus are all the elements and relations that go to create the centering synthesis. Here the initial amulet function of the symbol comes into play. The mandala is at first an amulet, encasing in presented patterning the full meaning structure that developed during the life career from the natural base. From nature to symbol and all in between, the self is presented to consciousness as a mandala. I suppose we should put in here, can be presented. That's probably more correct. The self can be presented to consciousness as a mandala. Jung's first mandala was drawn in 1916. A good color reproduction of this 1916 work appears as the frontispiece to Volume 9, Part 1 of his collected works, The Archetypes and the Collective Unconscious, which was published in 1959. And I see by the initials here that I bought it at that time. That's his first one. And a later, more powerful mandala of Jung's is included in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which was published in 1961 as Plate 9. And I think I have it here. So that there are two mandalas of Carl Jung's. The one in color is the first one. It's the first time anything came out of him. In other words, when he let go in 1913, he said he decided to drop into his unconscious. And he let everything go. And he fell. And it took him 3 years before this came out, this mandala. But this mandala is like a very cribbed, inarticulate, mechanical presentation. Within a couple of years, this second mandala came out, which is ever so much more powerful. In fact, the inscription that accompanies it is always that it's like a stained glass window. And around the central flower form are 8 stars. So that the nexes of energy here were understood by Jung as being stars, which indeed this is a very, very powerful symbol. I'll leave these two out, and you can see these are mandalas from Carl Jung. This work, the second mandala, this work also appears as an illustration in Alchemical Studies, Plate A3. So it's also in Alchemical Studies. Originally, the second mandala was in Jung's Red Book, which is, as yet, 1989, unpublished. His own personal record, illustrated by himself and written by himself. So that the originally, the second mandala was in the Red Book. Again, this second mandala of Jung's appears as Plate 3 in The Secret of the Golden Flower. And you can find it as Plate 3 in The Secret of the Golden Flower, published in English in 1930. All four of these works are of special interest in understanding Jung's own self and personality. In other words, when he made the mandala in the Red Book, it was an amulet. When he used the mandala in these published works, it became a talisman. And he meant consciously, he is very conscious, he meant, just like a magician, to put his talisman on these works in particular, to make sure that these four works work together. That they're linked together, if you will, by sympathetic magic. Not in any kind of hocus-pocus way, but in a very capable 20th century magician saying, I mean to put these together so that they form a whole, that the four of them together form a whole. Now, we don't have time here to go into all of this, but at some time I'll give a series taking these four together, which will be like the inner side of that series that I did on the alchemical core of Jung's work. I did 13 lectures on that at the PRS. And these four works are like the personal self. They're the quaternary of the inner self of Jung working, operating in his collected works, in his writings. Very, very powerful, foursome. Magic as a transformational media is directly related to nature, which is a transformational media in itself. Now, if you haven't been in the course, if you weren't there with us at the beginning, this sounds a little strange. What is meant is that nature is not statically there, but is there as a transformational media. And the right way to talk about nature is in vectors and matrices, and not in pounds and inches. Pounds and inches are very good for casual reference, but vectors and matrices are tensors are much better for what actually goes on, what actually happens. So that they are, in fact, together a continuum. Magic and nature together are a continuum. But this is a continuum with a twist, as it were. And I put twist in quotation marks because I'm using it in a colloquial sense. And there's a double entendre here. I mean a twist in the sense that there's a knack to seeing this, and I mean a twist in the sense that graphically one can produce this, for instance, in a Mobius strip configuration. When seen abstracted, that Mobius form in abstraction is seen as the infinity sign, a hermetic symbol of transformation in ancient and accepted tradition. It occurs in 25,006 different places. For instance, in the tarot deck, the magician and strength both have the infinity sign over their heads. And they are a pair. They're a royal pair. The two, magic and nature, are complementarities. The one subconscious or hidden or occult when the other is visible, conscious. Thus, magic is occult in nature. And nature is occult in magic. The inflated ego divorced from nature mistakes ritual for the natural horizon. And the chimera, do you know what a chimera is? Chimera is a false image, like putting a man and a horse together and making a centaur. A chimera is a made-up image. It doesn't actually occur. So that the inflated ego divorced from nature mistakes ritual for the natural horizon, thinks that ritual is the basis of all. And the chimera, magic ritual, or as it is called in Agrippa, a contemporary of Paracelsus, who was taught also by Trithemius, but did not receive any practical instruction or teaching from Trismegistus. So Agrippa got half the story and tried to stretch it to make it all and had no technical understanding whatsoever. Solomon Trismegistus was the greatest alchemist of his age. I'll show you sometime. I took a photograph. I made a slide from a manuscript that has never been published. It was written in 1531. It was written to commemorate Paracelsus being given the power to teach others. And the frontispiece of this secret manuscript, in fact, it says in brown ink on the old parchment that it's referred to as the secret manuscript. Mr. Hall has the only copy in the world, in the vault, and the frontispiece is a portrait, like a Rembrandt portrait of Solomon Trismegistus. And when you see his face, I mean, you can see No wonder the tradition was so strong. No wonder that kings and persecutors had no chance to dismember and erase a tradition upheld by men like that. But Agrippa did not receive the practical instruction. And so Henry Cornelius Agrippa is kind of like a soldier of fortune in the occult tradition, and his work on natural magic is very one-sided and very inflated. The point here is that when the ego does not have a contact with nature and it receives an infusion of psychic energy, the psychic energy carries a pattern of fullness with it all the time, kind of like a quaternary pattern of fullness, so that the estranged ego in the magical work looks to see what the basis of it is, and not having any contact with nature, not paying any attention to nature, thinks that ritual is the basis. And out of that comes then the basis of thinking that whatever magic ritual does, that has effect. Whereas in fact, the only effect that it has is to make very powerful games. The real effect comes when you realize that nature is the basis. Out of that comes science. And the whole shift that made science possible was that in Paracelsus, for the first time, you had somebody who saw that medicine is not just making sympathetic correspondences, but it's going into the chemical structure, iatrochemical medicine. That the chemical structure of the materials could be changed and introduced, and that would cure. It was the beginning of scientific medicine. And despite all of his shortcomings, Paracelsus is always welcomed into the Hall of Heroes, because he actually, he did manage to do that. He turned a very big corner in world history. So magic is occult in nature. Nature is occult in magic. The inflated ego, divorced from nature, mistakes ritual for the natural horizon, and the chimera, magic ritual, or as it is called in Agrippa and so forth, natural magic, is proclaimed. There's always a proclamatory kind of a tone to writings and people of this nature. I won't mention names, but the 20th century is chock full of them. But true nature magic is in fact science, not only in the modern era, but in antiquity too. It was well understood in antiquity, East and West. Magic is the transformational media commonly referred to as psychic energy by many of our contemporaries. Psychic energy it is, but always expressive of a symbolic focus. In other words, psychic energy doesn't just occur in an ambivalent way, but it always occurs expressively. It's an expressive energy which comes from a symbolic focus. So that when you're dealing with psychic energy, you want to deal with the symbolic focuses, not just any symbolic focuses. What is the symbolic focus of this energy? It's like when you first start a therapy and you work on the mythic horizon, feeling is always centered in images. And the whole purpose of initial therapy is to go into the feelings enough and let the feelings come into you enough to let the images form so that you can recognize the images. Once you see the image, then the feeling is knit together, and you can transform the image, and the feeling will be transformed. It really does happen. On a higher level, a more powerful level, one is working with psychic energy, not just with feeling. Feeling, thinking, sensation, intuition, all of it together, and a lot of dimensions that are almost never mentioned. Psychic energy is much more potent than just feeling. Feeling is potent enough. With feeling, one could create music. It's not paltry at all, but with psychic energy, one can create worlds. Life is very powerful. But the images don't control life. In psychic energy, one doesn't resolve it to the image, one resolves it to the symbol. Now, where are those symbols? The symbols are all together in the structure of the self. But the self is not like some kind of piece of diamond inside of you. It's a focus of all those forces, and the different facets are the different forces that come together. The forces of what? The forces of meaning. Of meaning. Very real. Very real. So that psychic energy it is, but always expressive of a symbolic focus, a self, and always in